For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging.
A group of researchers had decided to see how they could engineer the virus to make it completely vaccine resistant mutant, and they called it a polymutant spike, engineered spike. And that was published, and then within a couple of months, the Omicron variant emerged and it had all of those mutations plus some.
That was the voice of Professor Raina McIntyre, Professor of Global Biosecurity at the Kirby Institute at the University of New South Wales. She is an international expert on pandemics, how they start, and how they can be prepared for. She is one of the founders of AusSage, a multidisciplinary network of Australian experts publishing information to help us through the COVID-19 pandemic and beyond. Professor McIntyre has written a new book, which is released to the public on Tuesday, the 1st of November. The book is called Dark Winter, An Insider's Guide to Pandemics and Biosecurity. And I have to say, it is a first-rate read, as well as being vaguely terrifying. I was lucky enough to get an advance copy to it and to grab some precious time with Raina to talk about the book, SARS-CoV-2, the ethics of gain-of-function research, and much, much more. Raina McIntyre is my special guest today. The sentence that really hit me was late in the book where you say we are utterly unprepared. Can you expand on that? Do you mean about epidemics, or do you mean about the threats that might come from the biosecurity sphere?
I meant both. Despite the experience with the COVID pandemic, I think we would still be unprepared, and that covers a whole range of things, from stockpiling to being agile and responsive to health systems and managing health system surge and looking after the health workforce as well. But beyond that, I was also referring to the lack of awareness and the lack of frameworks really for governance of biosecurity, which really has to be global. These are pathogens don't recognize international borders, and the US has done probably a lot more than most countries in terms of thinking about governance of biosecurity. But you can do an experiment in one country that results in a accidental or deliberate pandemic that affects other countries. So that's the difficulty. And I think also in my career, I've spoken at quite a lot of security and police conferences, and there's like no awareness of, there's no methodology, I don't believe, not enough anyway, in the intelligence and law enforcement sector to know how to look for these threats and how to be prepared.
Why is it important to know the origin of an outbreak, whether it's natural or unnatural?
Well, because your response would be different for each one. They'd be similar for some things, like for a contagious pathogen that spreads from one person to another, the public health response is the same. If someone's deliberately released a pathogen or there's been a lab accident, you want to know, because you need to know how to rectify the situation, if it's a lab accident, how to reduce the risk next time. And as in the book, lab leaks are prolific and common. And if it's a deliberate act of biological warfare or bioterrorism, again, you need to know, just as you want to know if someone's about to nuke your country or, it's like, hey, we'll just take it as it comes, if there's error or terror involved. Yeah.
You make it pretty clear that you think there's every chance that COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 was released from a lab, whether accidentally or deliberately. Do you think that would change the Australian government's reaction to it, or would have changed it in the early days?
As I said, the basic response to something, particularly like SARS-CoV-2, which is highly contagious now, from person to person, is the same. So the core elements of response would not have changed. But I guess, that the number of different vested interests and the players involved and the stakes that are involved are so high that it makes it really difficult to even to step into that area.
Do you understand why the government is reacting the way it is now in terms of lifting restrictions, in terms of this living with COVID? Do you understand what the forces are at work that's making them behave that way?
A couple of state elections that are one very close and one not so far away. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know. But again, as I said, in biosecurity, there are vested interests everywhere. So you have to look at what are the vested interests, who the powerful players are, and what sort of influence they have in decisions.
Let's talk about gain of function research. What does that mean, and what sort of a threat does it pose as opposed to the advantages of it?
So gain of function research is a subset of dual use research of concern. And to begin with, dual use research of concern applies to any technology that can be used for benefit but also for harm. So it might be robotics or artificial intelligence or biological technology, where the primary purpose is to benefit humanity, whether it's for medicines, vaccines, for agriculture, for defence, for other types of purposes. But the exact same technology can also be used to harm humanity. So gain of function research is where you usually engineer a pathogen to confer on it properties it didn't confer naturally. And this began, really hit the headlines in 2012 when two groups of scientists in the world had done gain-of-function research on avian influenza viruses. Avian influenza viruses are not contagious in humans because the respiratory tract of birds is different in terms of the receptors to humans. So with the different receptor makeup in the respiratory tract, those viruses cannot easily be contagious between humans. You can get humans who die of avian influenza, and usually they're people who've been poultry handlers or otherwise working in very close contact with sick or dead birds. So these groups took these avian flu viruses and repeatedly passaged them through ferrets, which are a good human proxy model for humans because they have the same makeup of the respiratory tract receptors. And basically, when you passage a virus repeatedly through a species, you help it to adapt to that species and pick up. In this case, the virus was conferred with properties that made it suitable for human-to-human transmission because ferrets, you know, have the same respiratory tract receptors. Yep. And so when the virus picked up those characteristics, it now becomes easily transmissible from human to human. So they've taken an avian flu virus that is not transmissible easily between humans and conferred on it pandemic potential.
Why would they have done that? What would be the benefit to humans for doing that?
So their arguments were that it helps with making vaccines against a pandemic should it arise and should it be the same virus as the one they engineered. Now, as we know, that you can never predict what virus is going to naturally emerge. And influenza particularly, we don't have universal influenza vaccines. They have to be exactly matched to the antigenic makeup of the virus. So there's no way you could predict the virus and make a vaccine for it. So this kind of polarized the scientific community. One group that was adamant that this was essential research and we had to do it and, you know, the future of humanity was at stake. They actually used those words. There was another group, which include Donald Henderson, who was one of the leaders of smallpox eradication, and Michael Osterholm in the US, who cautioned against the use of gain-of-function research or against publishing the methods. That the thing that was controversial in this case was that these papers were going to be published in scientific journals where anyone could access them and therefore understand the methods and reproduce the methods. But so for a period of time, there was a moratorium on that kind of research, initially in 2011, but there was a lot of pressure after that. And then the National Science Advisory Board on Biodefence, which was the body formed in the US after the 9/11 anthrax attacks. No other country had a body like that. Only the US even had a body that sat down and considered these things back in 2011. They decided to look into this and put a hold on publishing such research, but there was so much pressure that by about May 2012, that was overturned and the papers were published. And that was it. The gates were open. Hundreds and hundreds of papers, if not thousands, have been published since.
Yeah. Has the same thing been done with coronaviruses?
Oh, absolutely. Ever since SARS first occurred, scientists have been fascinated with the virus. And since around 2014, for engineering a SARS version 2 have been published and made accessible. Yes, plenty of groups were doing that kind of research and on other viruses too.
In your book, you mentioned some September 21 research in Nature about Omicron containing a lot of the same mutations that had been engineered to see if it would be vaccine proof. Is that right? Am I reading that correctly?
Resistant. Yeah, a group of researchers had decided to see how they could engineer the virus to make it completely vaccine resistant mutant, and they called it a polymutant spike, engineered spike, and that was published. And then within a couple of months, the Omicron variant emerged, and it had all of those mutations plus some.
Wow. What do we take from, what can we imply from that? That Omicron was manufactured, or that the researchers were right and that's how it evolved?
As I say in the, in the book, there are some things that I don't say outright. I'll just call it Easter eggs, which is more a term used in computer games.
Yep, but yep.
There are Easter eggs in the book, and people who are switched on and who are following the topics can read between the lines. That's all I will say.
Fair enough. One of the things that I learned from the book, and perhaps that this shows my lack of awareness about biosecurity, that there are over 200 unregulated private companies in synthetic biology, three of them in Australia.
Probably more than 200 now.
My impression was that this kind of research was done in very secure, locked-down facilities, and that there was, 17,000 words of regulation to stop these kind of escapes happening. How is it then that we have an unregulated industry?
It's not entirely unregulated. It's governed by a voluntary code of conduct.
Mm.
So those companies are meant to report if someone orders a particular sequence of some dangerous pathogen. And I've heard of examples, of people doing particular kinds of research who've had their order refused because of what they requested. So it does work on some cases, but obviously if it's self-regulated, everyone has their price, and there's got to be a point where it's possible to bypass that regulation. And of course, if it's self-regulated, you've got no control over the industry. And the other point is that, the technology for both synthetic biology and genetic engineering has not only become more advanced, but also cheaper and more accessible. And it's not just what happens in official labs. I talk a bit about the biohacker movement and and, just as you see people making methamphetamine in their kitchens, so too you could set up a do-it-yourself biology lab in your house. It's not necessarily a lab that you're going to know about. If someone has nefarious intent, they're not going to put a big neon sign on their lab and say this is a biohacker lab. They'll be doing it in a clandestine way, and means the cost, everything is in favour of that kind of scenario occurring.
Do you think that's something that needs to be legislated? Does it need to be changed?
It definitely needs to be looked at. There is, biohacking labs are supposed to operate at BSL-1 level, but there's no governance mechanism to monitor it or police it. Something law enforcement does, although the FBI started attending biohacking conferences from 2009 because they picked it as something to watch. And, there was a guy in California who I talk about who got charged with practicing medicine without a license for injecting himself with CRISPR-Cas9 on live streaming himself, bioengineer himself.
You talk a lot about smallpox in the book. You make the point that if a smallpox outbreak happens, then it must be unnatural because smallpox has been eradicated or only exists in labs. Is smallpox something you worry about?
Yes, it is, because it is a very high consequence pathogen, got a very high case fatality rate, around 30%, and SARS-CoV-2, the case fatalities may be 1% or less, especially with vaccines. We do have effective vaccines against smallpox, but as we saw when the monkeypox outbreak occurred, there's been very little preparation for all the pox virus events, and we didn't have third generation vaccines and we didn't have antivirals against all the pox viruses in our national medical stockpile. And, you know, that was all a big scramble. If I had been in charge of stockpiling, I would have stockpiled those things in 2017-18, because there were two big warning signs back then. One was that a Canadian group synthetically created an extinct orthopox virus in a lab, proving that you can make smallpox in a lab. You don't need to break into Vector in Russia or CDC in the US, make it in a lab. And it wasn't terribly expensive, and it wasn't an absolute top-tier lab with whiz-bang equipment, you know. So It could be done. And that kind of, until then, all the security intelligence types had been told that it's too difficult to make smallpox, so don't worry about it. And that kind of blew that theory out of the water. And then, but 20 years ago, actually, some Australian scientists did some work using another orthopox virus called ectromelia virus or mousepox. All the orthopox viruses are extremely closely related genetically. So if you can make one, you can make another. And they engineered ectromelia virus to try to counter the mouse plague that we see in rural Australia. And what they were trying to do was infect mice with this engineered virus that then caused them to create antibodies to their eggs, the female mice to their eggs.
Yeah, make them infertile.
And what they found was that the virus was universally fatal to the mice and resistant to the smallpox vaccine, which works against all of the orthopox viruses. So that methodology is also out there, which shows you can engineer an orthopox virus to make it universally fatal and resistant to vaccines. And if you don't have the vaccines available, then it's a different game altogether. And with every serious emerging epidemic, we've seen lots of stumbling and fumbling at the beginning and misdiagnoses and delays. And delaying a truly epidemic infection means it spreads. That's exactly what happened in Wuhan. Mm-hmm. Spread, you know, if it had been detected really early, it could have been stamped out before it spread. And smallpox, we don't know how contagious it would be today. It could be engineered to be highly contagious. It was about as contagious as the original SARS-CoV-2 2020, but that was in an era where there was lots of natural immunity and people had been recently vaccinated. It could be much more contagious now because the R0 might be different in a non-immune population. We've done research that's estimated it's close to 5.
Wow.
The US CDC also estimated it's close to 5. So we do a smallpox scenario where I use data from the last European smallpox outbreak, which was in the former Yugoslavia. We created the scenario around that case, but it was, you know, in a fictional setting. But what happened there was that Yugoslavia hadn't seen any smallpox for 30 years. This was the 1970s. It returned from the Middle East and had smallpox. They presented with hemorrhagic smallpox and the diagnosis was just completely missed.
Yes.
Clinicians hadn't seen it. They weren't familiar with it. They thought the guy had sepsis and they gave him all kinds of antibiotics. Then they thought he had an adverse reaction to antibiotics. And so they called lots of medical students and people to come and interesting rash. Lots of medical students to watch the autopsy as well. So they had a huge outbreak of smallpox and they didn't realize it until the second generation of cases started occurring.
Wow.
So we saw it with Ebola again and again, like in Nigeria in 2014. Case was misdiagnosed initially and that allowed it to spread. Lots of healthcare workers died, etc. And we saw it with Ebola in Dallas, Texas as well in 2014, where diagnosis wasn't picked up. The person had returned from West Africa, had traveled from West Africa at the height
of big red flag,
and nobody picked up. So we're missing something at that point of triage, you know, where at the point of triage, you must have a system that you're not where you're less likely to miss those high consequence pathogens.
I'm chatting today with Professor Raina McIntyre from the Kirby Institute at UNSW about her new book, Dark Winter, An Insider's Guide to Pandemics and Biosecurity. Links to the publisher's website, the AusSage website, and to the website for EpiWatch are available in the show notes to this podcast. If this pod has sparked your interest and you'd like to hear more, you can find our back catalogue at mja.com.au/podcasts, where they are all free to access. If you would like to be notified each time we publish a new episode, you can search for the Medical Journal of Australia on your favourite podcast platform and just hit the subscribe button. Back to our chat with Raina. You mentioned early detection there. Talk to us a little bit about EpiWatch and what that can do and what its potential is.
So EpiWatch is something, again, I became interested in and started thinking about in 2014 during the West African Ebola epidemic, which was so catastrophic. And in that case, there had been a very long delay in responding. So we sort of started two bodies of work. One was to develop risk analysis tools that will give you a risk prediction of an emerging epidemic, develop something called EpiRisk along those lines, which is part of the EpiWatch suite of tools. And then we started developing this early warning system using open source data. So traditional surveillance in public health relies on doctors and hospitals, laboratories to send notifications. By the time those notifications land on the desk at the health department and someone's put together the data and looked at the patterns, it's often quite delayed. And by that time, especially if you've got a disease with a short incubation period, it's already spread. So time and time again, we see this situation where by the time the drugs and vaccines arrive, the peak of the epidemic's already over. Haven't prevented all those cases and those deaths because, we saw it in 2009 in the flu pandemic. We got vaccine in Australia by September, I think, and yes, the peak was in May, June, or before we had the vaccine anyway. Mm-hmm. Same with SARS-CoV-2, most of 2020 was spent without vaccines and there was a lot of death and illness that year. So, but that's where all the investment is. All the investment is in treating, diagnosing, antivirals, vaccines, diagnostics. Mm-hmm. But all of that's very late in the piece and at the pointy end. And prevention is better than cure. If you can prevent that altogether, if we could have prevented COVID, if it had never occurred or just been relegated to the archives of history as an interesting little outbreak. That
was that a possibility? Could it have been shut down?
Every epidemic starts with one or a few cases, and then if it's a true epidemic disease, it grows exponentially in numbers by spreading person to person. And so if you pick it up really early, you can stamp it out by isolating cases, by tracing their contacts and quarantining their contacts. Just those two things can stop it spreading. So in the case of COVID, if it had been detected very early when it was a handful of cases and those measures had been taken, then it could have been stopped from spreading outside of even Wuhan. The objective of EpiWatch is to get an early signal using open source data, because people talk about what's happening in the community long before the health department gets that notification on its desk. News reports, local news agencies report about unusual outbreaks long before it's officially known about. So we started doing research on it, on using open source data, and published a number of papers showing you could pick up signals much earlier, including Ebola in 2014. We looked retrospectively and were able to get a signal in late 2013 for that epidemic. And so EpiWatch then, by 2018, we developed it into an automated AI-based system, which has two layers of artificial intelligence in it. And since then, with another grant, we've taken it to the next level, and it's had a lot of interest from a lot of stakeholders around the world. Tried at the National Incident Room as well.
When did it throw up a flag about COVID?
Retrospectively, because at the time in late 2019, which is when COVID was starting, we'd run out of funds for it. We had one grant that was a five-year grant under which we developed it. So there was no staff, no one to be monitoring it. It was up and running, but no one to monitor it, no staff. So in the following year, in 2020, we got another grant to resume all the work on EpiWatch, which is why, you need to invest in that kind of technology. And a lot of countries have invested in this kind of technology in 2021, post-COVID, right? US set up Center for Pandemic Analytics and Forecasting in within the CDC and the UK announced a pandemic radar initiative. WHO set up a pandemic hub in Berlin. A lot of initiatives have occurred since COVID, but we've been working on this much longer than that.
Is it throwing up any signals at the moment?
Well, there's signals every day about different things. One of the things we've been watching since May is, we call it monkeypox watch, to see whether there's rash and fever illnesses that are being misdiagnosed as something else, like chickenpox or hand, foot and mouth disease. Mm-hmm. So we've got a collection of things we're scanning for, and we keep an eye on that in case.
Could monkeypox be masking smallpox?
Well, if we started seeing cases of rash and fever illness that could look like an orthopox virus, the first assumption would be it's monkeypox, because we've just had a big epidemic globally in non-endemic countries. Yes, it's another one of those things that could result in delay in diagnosis. And we were quite interested in the tomato fever epidemics in India as well. And it's been sort of been in the news the last couple of months, but we've been watching it for longer than that. We were curious about what is this tomato fever that keeps getting reported in India. And it turns out it's just a term that they use, including for things like chikungunya and dengue, based on, you know, rash and fever. So on syndromes as well, and we look at unusual things, and we put out a weekly digest that also summarizes all the outbreaks of interest every week and highlights the ones that are unknown, sort of unknown diseases or mystery diseases, which are SARS-CoV-2 when it started would have been an unknown pneumonia.
AusSage has been pushing the vaccine plus strategy. If you were in charge, if you were queen for the day, Raina, what would you do right now to sort out the situation we're in now with COVID?
It would be a layered strategy. The first is get the booster rates up as high as they could be and look at expanding the eligibility for fourth doses and also be looking at fifth doses. One point I make in the book is that in a pandemic, vaccine policy has to be agile. The way we normally do vaccine policy in business as usual is quite prolonged and considered, as it should be. But in a pandemic where you're talking about when you've already got your ancestral vaccines, you know the safety profile, etc., and if you're changing the antigenic composition of the vaccine to match a new variant, then there's no point waiting till the peak of the epidemic to make a recommendation. Then it's going to benefit the country most if people are vaccinated to face an oncoming wave. And I think that's kind of what we've done, reactive policy that's kind of been too late and too little. I would be looking at vaccinating of children under 5, because not only for acute illness and the recognised complications like multisystems inflammatory syndrome in children and the paediatric hepatitis, which I think is linked to SARS-CoV-2, but also for long COVID, because there are now plenty of studies that show that children can suffer long COVID. I actually think all of this and our management of COVID matters the most for children. There's one recent study, quite a large study from Denmark, I think, which shows that the risk of long COVID is actually highest in kids 0 to 3. What are we actually doing to our children? They're the adults of tomorrow. A bit like telling them all to go out in the sun and get sun for their health like they did 30, 40 years ago, we realised that was dangerous, and after the slip, slop, slap campaign. Is it like that? You know, are the children of today going to be thanking us when they're adults? So I would be really focusing on what we can do to maintain the health and lives of our children and young adults. I would be looking at antivirals. To me, it matters most for young people. They've got their whole lives ahead of them. They should be able to access antivirals at a subsidized cost. And because we don't know, the data will come, but from an empirical sense of first principles and biological plausibility, it makes sense that if you reduce viral load, reduce viral shedding, reduce the burden of virus in your body, you will reduce some of those long COVID risks, because we know the virus can persist in the body, it can persist in the brain, in the heart, in the lungs, in the gut, in all kinds of almost every organ system of the body long after the acute infection. Yet we don't prescribe it for people with debilitating long COVID. You know, we should be developing very clear diagnostic triage and treatment protocols for long COVID, prevent long COVID, and that's obviously the vaccine plus strategy, which is masks in on public transport and crowded public places, make it easy, provide the masks for free. And that's better for the economy because you're going to have less workplace absence and more productivity when people aren't getting sick all the time and needing to go off sick. And I'd look at safe indoor air, and I think there's a lot of resistance to that because people think that's necessarily expensive, but it's not. It's a matter of just measuring. So monitoring, measuring, identifying areas, and it may only be a couple of spots in your building that are at high risk and have low ventilation, and then checking whether you can open the windows or doors or alter the HVAC system to mitigate that, and then test again. Yeah. And if that doesn't work, you know, a portable air purifier will usually do the trick. It's not that expensive. There's kind of a very systematic way you can approach it. And I think solutions like Fire UVC, they will come. There will come a time in the next 5 to 10 years, I think, where that will be standard in many public places because it's a much more passive way of cleaning the air and not having to rely, so it doesn't matter if people are not complying with wearing masks, etc.
If we continue as we are with restrictions as they are or not, that's more likely. Do you see an end to this epidemic?
Well, no, there's no sign that it's coming to an end. There's, as they keep saying, this first few waves were very distinct new variants that kind of completely took over and became dominant. Now, at this time, in this last month or so, we've had a huge mix of different variants and there isn't one clear winner, you know, that's coming out as dominant and causing the next wave. So that's a bit of an unusual situation. And these newest variants like XXB, et cetera, are highly immune evasive. Having been infected with BA1 in February gives you virtually zero protection against these newer variants. So
herd immunity, hybrid immunity, endemic, all of these words are meaningless, aren't they?
It is meaningless. And as I say in the book, herd immunity is a concept that arose from vaccination programs. No infection has ever eliminated itself through herd immunity. Yeah. You need vaccines. And, you know, we don't have perfect vaccines, but we've got reasonably good vaccines that actually were pretty damn good against the ancestral variant to which they were designed. They prevented infection. They prevented transmission. They were very highly efficacious vaccines, even though the efficacy waned. There's still hope that we'll get better vaccines, that we'll get universal vaccines, and we need to keep working towards that, but also using other measures to mitigate risk. And I think removing isolation is one of those things that's just going to make it harder to mitigate transmission. It's the children and the young people who are going to hurt the most because they've got their whole lives ahead of them. It doesn't matter so much if I get dementia in a couple of years from having had COVID 3 times, which I have now, heart failure from having COVID, or if I get a pulmonary embolus. It doesn't matter so much to me because I've lived most of my life. Mm. But it matters a hell of a lot for my children, for the children of today. They deserve to have that security of a safe future where they've got their health.
When you set out to write the book, what was your aim? What did you want people to get from the book, apart from terrified?
Well, I'd actually written a novel, you know, some time ago, which was really trying to convey my concerns about biosecurity and where we're headed, the acceleration of technology and the kind of convergence of different kinds of threats. And I couldn't get anyone interested in the novel. So then the publisher from New South Press approached me in 2020 initially and said, do you want to write a book, nonfiction? And I said, no, I'm just too busy. Check back next year. And then she approached me again in 2021. I said yes and crazily gave a very short deadline in time I could provide a full manuscript, which was June this year. But the purpose is really to convey my knowledge in a digestible format for anyone to read and understand. And because I believe in the democratization of knowledge, a lot of the knowledge that I talk about is held in very tight-knit scientific circles, and it's only debated among scientists and policymakers. We have a lot of awareness of climate change and cybersecurity. We've got zero awareness of biosecurity, which is an equal existential threat. Do was break those barriers and make that knowledge accessible and democratize it.
Well, you've certainly done that, Raina. It's a terrific read, and I learned humongous amounts, so thank you for that. What's your big focus for the next, say, 6 months?
Well, we've got a study under an MRFF grant looking at SARS-CoV-2 transmission in hospitals.
Yep.
So that will be taking up a bit of our time. And, of course, EpiWatch is a major focus. You know, it's something that you continuously improve. So there's a whole lot of work that we're undertaking in EpiWatch. A few unknowns what direction it's going to go in, but it's pretty exciting. Looking at other things, like we did a bit of work looking at picking up signals of radiation or nuclear events in Ukraine, you know.
Cool. So, yeah.
Different search terms, but you've got to test and train the system and make sure it's valid. So we'll be looking at other things. And one of the other developments we'll be looking at is trying to monitor, get early warning signals for community sentiment for things that can derail an epidemic response, like disinformation or anti-vaccine sentiment, etc. And this is from feedback we've had from health stakeholders in Australia, from health departments and so on.
Thank you so much for your time, Raina. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure, Kate.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.